We're continuing today in our series in Genesis, and we're calling this series The Story That Makes Sense of All of Our Stories. Because as Christians, we actually believe this. We believe that there is a story that exists in Scripture at the very beginning of the Bible that if the world knew it, would radically change this world. That it's that important that if we learned this story by heart, we would begin to see miracles happening around us all the time. We would begin to see lives changed. We would begin to see great structures of evil toppled over. That's how powerful we believe this story is. And the rest of Scripture is really an unfolding of what this story in Genesis 1 all the way through Genesis 11 tells us. This is the beginning of the story. This is the framework, and the rest of the story then builds on it and then explains why things are the way they are. So that's why we're focusing on these 11 chapters at the very beginning of the Bible. Now, last week, Paul started us off in chapter 1, which is the first account of creation. In Genesis, there's actually two different accounts of creation. The first is in chapter 1, and it goes all the way to chapter 2, verse 3, which is a little bit strange. We're not sure. Someone, I don't know, maybe while they were transcribing, what about a professor who said, they must have fallen off their horse. Claudia could do a better accent than I can. But someone put the chapter a little bit early, we think. But the first account is in this chapter 1, all the way to 2, verse 3. And then the second account we're going to talk about next week, Genesis 2, all the way to the end, into chapter 3. Now, Genesis 1, the first account, it's almost as though if you picture we're with God looking down, we're in the heavens, in this sort of atmosphere, looking at all of creation from God's perspective. And then in Genesis chapter 2, it gives us an account that's a little more earthy. It's more like we're looking at the story from with our feet firmly planted on the ground, looking at things from a more earthly perspective. But today, I'm going to talk again about Genesis chapter 1 because there's so much in it that we wanted to spend at least 2 weeks on it. And so I'm going to give a slightly different emphasis, take a slightly different angle than Paul did last week, but it's the same story. And it begins with these words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. The Jesus Storybook Bible is one of my favorite kids illustrated Bibles. And I love the way the author, Sally Lloyd-Jones, interprets this passage. I think it's my favorite interpretation. I think, if I remember correctly, there's a picture of like a mother hen at the very Genesis 1. It's kind of unexpected. And she writes, like a mother bird flutters her wings over her eggs to help her babies hatch, God hovered over the deep, silent darkness, and he was making life happen. Jesus uses this image later in the Gospels to talk about God being like a mother hen, or Jesus being like a mother hen who longs to gather the children under her wings. And John writes that Jesus was present at the beginning of creation. And so as Christians, we can't help but think a little bit in terms of this imagery as we read God hovering over, the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. When all was dark, when all was chaotic, without purpose or meaning or function, God was there. The very first thing we're told before we learn how our world came to be or how we came to be, the first thing we're told is that God was there. More specifically, the Spirit of God was there. I love the word for spirit in Hebrew. It's ruach, and you kind of need like breath in the back of your throat to say it. And it means, it can also be translated as life and breath. And it's used in the Old Testament to describe God's life-giving presence, like his very essence and energy. It's the same breath that God breathes into humans. He creates Adam out of clay, it says, and then he breathes his life. It's like he breathes his spirit into him, and that's what makes him come alive. And it's the same breath that Jesus breathed over his disciples to fill them with his power and his spirit after he was resurrected, so that they could do the things that he did in the earth, on the earth. In the beginning, when all was dark and empty, the breath of life itself was stirring. And soon, words would be formed out of this breath and would bring something into being that had never, ever existed before. God's words, his spirit, the life that exudes from God, saturates and initiates everything that comes into being. The universe does not exist, according to this story, apart from God's presence there together. So the Board of Stewards was up at Meredith's cottage this weekend. And it's not Meredith's cottage, it's actually her parents' cottage, and they were gracious enough to host us there. They were not there, but Meredith was the host in their place. And Meredith made a confession to us. She said, "I have to confess, when I am in my own home, I'm usually a lot more laid back about tidiness and house rules. But here, in my mother's cottage, I feel like she's hovering beside me all the time, kind of making sure that I'm taking care of her stove the way she would take care of it, or taking care of this room in the way that she would, because she loves this place." Genesis 1 presents creation as God's meticulously designed and well-loved house, his home, a place where he is constantly present, even hovering like our mothers, though we don't always see him. And this universe is his beloved home, and in case we forget it, he calls it good 7 times in this first chapter. God's house, of course, is not exactly like our mothers' houses. And his hovering isn't exactly like our mothers' hovering. This metaphor only goes so far. God's house in Genesis 1 is all of the universe. It is creation. And his hovering is his constant, creative, and caring presence. So what about us? What role do we play in this house of God's? Are we like adult kids? And I know all of us who have visited our parents' homes before, as adults, know this feeling, aware of our independence and our capability, and yet still sensing that maybe God is looking over our shoulders, wondering why we're doing things that way, or making sure that we don't mess things up. Is that our role in this house of God's, in this created world? Or is it something different? Well, in order to answer that question, we have to know more about who God is. And Genesis 1 suggests that we can learn a lot about someone by looking at their house. And this is true, isn't it, right? When we visit someone's house, we see the knickknacks on the wall, we see the particular art that they chose to hang, we see the way they chose the paint colors, and you can learn a lot about someone just by sitting there and looking at their house. Well, Genesis 1 gives us a good description of God's house. Oh, like a mom, yep. Creation is God's house. In the ancient times, God's houses were called temples. They were temples. And temples were built by humans for the gods. And they were modeled after the universe to show how powerful the gods were, that all the things in the universe were in their house because they were the rulers of everything. So the layout, the location of the house, the decor, or the temple, all were designed as a replica of the created universe. And some of the most spectacular ancient temples were in Egypt. Has anyone here been to Egypt and visited any of the ruins of the temples or anything? No one here. That's interesting. I haven't either. But we have definitely seen documentaries, we've seen pictures and books of these spectacular ruins of these temples that were built. Now, an interesting note about some of these temples is that they were built by Israelite slaves, a lot of them. For a period of history, Israel lived as a minority ethnicity group in Egypt, and they were growing, and as a threat, they were kept as slaves to help build Pharaoh's homes, build the temples, and the cities of the gods in Egypt. And this is important for us because the book of Genesis was written probably only a generation after Israel had been rescued from slavery in Egypt. So this would have been very fresh in their minds. And it makes sense that if God was going to tell them about how he created the world, who he was, and who they were, he would use language that they would understand. And so we find in Genesis 1 a lot of temple-building language. Now, I have to tell you, I have been reading the Genesis story and hearing it in Sunday school since I was a little kid. And I never knew and never got any inkling that A, Genesis 1 was a song or a poem, or B, that it was a song or a poem about building a temple. It's not really obvious to us as we read through it. But if you were an Israelite who came from a family who had just recently been building these massive temples, you would have been well-versed in temple songs, and you would know that this is actually a temple-building song in Genesis 1. For example, here's one of the things you would notice. It takes 7 days, in the ancient world, it took 7 days to bless a new temple. Because seven was a really important number. In the ancient times, numbers held values or symbolic values, so they meant seven things, just like it means for us. But it also, the number seven also meant completion or perfection, a sense of wholeness. And so it took 7 days to bless an ancient temple. Now, how many days does God create the world in Genesis 1? Seven. And so this would have been a hint. This song might be about a temple. Another clue is this. Towards the end of blessing a new temple, so it had just been built, it was now about to start functioning. Towards the end, it was common to place an image, which is literally translated a statue, of the god or the king, because often kings were thought of to be the direct descendants of the god, in the temple. And what does God do on the sixth day, so towards the end? He creates us in his image, and we are placed in this created world, a temple. That would have been another hint. This song is kind of like a temple song. And finally, and perhaps the biggest clue, that this song is about temple building is what happens on day number seven. So on the seventh day of a temple inauguration, the god would enter the temple, sit down on his throne, if there was a throne, and begin his glorious reign from the temple. And this was called entering his rest. So it wasn't like going to take a nap, all the work is done, I'm going to go take a nap. It was like the actual beginning of the temple functioning as the temple was supposed to be. The place where the God dwelled and lived, and the place from which he ruled. And so what do we find God doing on the seventh day? We find him entering his rest. We find him resting, which doesn't mean that God said, great, the world's done, I'll be in the back room taking a nap for a while because that was exhausting. But it means that God moves in, that creation is finally becoming what it was meant to be, the home of God from which he reigns, where he is present and where he dwells. And so just like Jesus, when he was speaking to fishermen and farmers, used a lot of parables and stories about fishing and farming to talk about what the kingdom of God was like, God used temple language to help the ancient Israelites who had just come out of Egypt to help them understand what the world was like and who he was and who we are in that world. Now, you can imagine coming out of Egypt, you'd have some preconceived ideas about what this God who was building temple basically by your sweat and blood was like, and what your role was as you cowered under these massive statues of the king and of the gods. Maybe not a great picture of who we are and who the rulers of the world are. And so God gives them an alternative picture. He rewrites their story. Creation is God's house. It's his temple. And he is unlike any god that there is or had been in that world. Every single inch of this universe is God's. There is no part of the created world that his hand has not touched and his spirit has not hovered over. All of the raw materials that have made up the world's great art and the skyscrapers and microchips and the internet and orchestras and currencies, all of these things came about from God's created world. His good creation. His fingerprints are on absolutely everything. Creation is God's house, and he loves it. Just like Meredith's mom loves her cottage, and we loved Meredith's mom's cottage too. Creation is God's house. You see, Christianity, one of the major things that sets Christianity apart from a lot of the main philosophies or world religions is that Christianity doesn't believe, or Judeo-Christianity, because this is from the Jewish tradition, doesn't believe that the world is a problem that we have to overcome or escape. Right in the beginning of the story, God creates this world as his home, as his dwelling place. He invites us into it, and he calls it good. It's something that has worth and value in and of itself, because God loved it and called it good. Creation is God's house, and he has moved into it. He is here in all of the places of breathtaking beauty and in all of the places that are really ordinary and normal. And even in the dark places, in the shadows where evil is done, if we looked, we would find his spirit there too, hovering, just like it was at the beginning, sheltering, bringing forth life out of darkness. Well, if creation is a temple, and we are like these images that God has placed in it, what does that mean for who we are? It's pretty incredible. See, in the ancient world, humans made these images of the gods. They made statues of the gods and of the kings. And these statues functioned as the gods or the kings' representatives. So this can be a little hard for us to wrap our minds around, but the image wasn't considered the king or the god itself, but it was considered to contain the essence of the god or the essence of the king. And so if that statue was there, even if the king wasn't physically present, it was like he was because his essence was there in that image, in that statue. And so these were placed in the temples so that the god would be present in that place through these images. And people then interacted with the gods by interacting with the statues that they had made of them, the images that represented, they were like the ambassadors, the royal ambassadors of God in that place. In Genesis 1, we find a god building a temple and putting images in it, but they're different than any images the Israelites might have been familiar with before. Because these ones are not made out of stone, and they're not made out of wood. They're not made out of any of that. God himself makes them out of clay, and then he breathes his own breath, his own spirit into them, and they come alive. The images of God in this story are human beings themselves, not man-made, but God-made. And this is why in the Judeo-Christian tradition, we don't make idols, we don't make images, because we believe that God made us as his images. And that's glorious and enough. So we don't need to serve God through these things. Somehow, we show the world who God is. Somehow we are his ambassadors in his temple. We are the ones who show that he is present in this world. And so God created humanity in his own image, it says. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Now I want you to just use your imagination for a second and put yourself in the place of the Israelites who are hearing this for the first time. Imagine your grandparents, or maybe parents who are still alive, had been slaves in Egypt, forming the massive bricks that made the Egyptian king's palace, working day and night under the shadow of these massive statues, these massive images that represented the authority and the presence of the god in Egypt. You see, everyone who was in Egypt worked underneath the authority and in the shadow of these statues. It was a very hierarchical society. You knew your place, and your place, unless you were the king, was underneath this statue. Now imagine hearing this story for the first time. When God created the heavens and the earth, he didn't set up this one king to rule as his image bearer. He set up every single human being as the king or the queen. No longer was there this big statue because every single person represented what that had represented. They were now the royal rulers in the earth. God says, I've created them in my image so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over all the livestock and all the wild animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground. When God created us in his image, he created us as these royal rulers of the earth. And not just us here, not just us who believe, but he created every single human being, male or female, all descended from a common ancestor to rule as his royal heirs. In writing this, I have to admit, I was praying for grace because I felt at a loss for words to express how huge this is, how powerful this concept of humanity is. Can you imagine if this is what we actually believed about humanity? One of the reasons that I find that our faith is compelling to me, one of the reasons I am a Christian, is because I don't think any other story imbues human beings with as much dignity and glory and worth as this story does. It's mind-blowing that God would create us in his own image, breathe his own spirit into us, and say, here, live in this temple, this home of mine with me, and represent who I am to the world. It's amazing. When Jesus came to earth, he showed us in a very helpful, grounded way what this looks like, what it looks like to be human and to also be the image of God. And he lived this reality by making friends with people in all strata of society. He made friends. He listened to and he defended women who at the time were mere property. He lived this reality by eating with sort of the riffraff of society, with sex trade workers, money launderers, religious extremists. And he said to these people who he called his friends, he said, I didn't come to call you my servants, like the ancient gods and kings in their big temples. I came to call you my friends. Genesis 1 says that human beings were created as God's own rulers, as his friends, to bring about the full glory of his creation. And this is our story. It's one of radical equality amongst humans, and it's one of radical glory, I think, as well. Surely this is no ordinary world that God has created, and our God is no ordinary God. Now, this idea that the earth is God's temple, and this idea that we are his images, his royal representatives in this temple, have a ton of implications. But I want to focus on just two this morning. And the first one might seem very obvious. The first is that God is everywhere. Now you might think, yeah, okay, we know that. God, all present, he's everywhere. He dwells, all over the place. But we don't often live that reality. I don't think we often actually believe that God is everywhere in this earth. We often live a lot more like somehow he's with us and we have to like bring him into places. But this is his house. He lives in this world. Now, most of us live in an suburban context. And one of the things you know if you move into a suburban context is that the first thing you need is a car. You can try and make it work on a bike, but it's hard to live in Oakville with just a bike. Sharon is nodding because I know she's tried, which I respect and love. But they aren't set up to be pedestrian and bike friendly. Suburban areas are set up in distinct spheres. So we do all of our shopping in these blocks over here. And then we do, let's see, what are my examples? We do all of our sports and recreation in this sort of center here. And then we have a big building for our education, and we tend to do education in these different areas. And we have to drive to them because they're big and they're far apart. And then we do our worshiping in a particular area. And usually we make our money by driving out of our suburban area and making it in cities around that. Now, there's some really good reasons for designing our cities like this, but what it tends to mean is that the activities in our lives become increasingly separated. And because we're busy people involved in things that take place in all these different areas, we increasingly feel tugged and pulled in different directions. It can feel like our lives are lots of different pieces rather than whole and cohesive, something that fits together. And so, unfortunately, our spiritual lives are impacted by that, right? Because we do our spiritual things in the spiritual places, but it's hard to imagine what Sunday worship has to do with our grocery shopping and our trips through the superstore and, you know, sitting and watching our kids' soccer games. It can be hard to figure out how those pieces fit together. But what if all of these separate spheres and rooms, separate spheres were like rooms in God's house? And what if he was present, hovering, not negative hovering, but a good kind of mother hen hovering? What if he was hovering around in all the corners of these rooms? Over Thanksgiving, my whole family gathered at my parents' farmhouse, which feels really tight. It's not a small house, but when all of us are there, there's four kids, we've got two spouses, and we've got two grandkids now. It starts to feel tight. And Sammy and Bella are the little ones, and they, at least Sammy, who's now two, it manages to somehow be everywhere at the same time. And he's doing stuff. He's really busy. And he has these, his favorite thing right now are sort of like the big Duplo blocks. It's the entryway into Lego. So pumped for that stage. But he's got Duplo, and he's making things and making towers. And, I mean, you can't really recognize what he's making yet. He's two, but I can tell you as an aunt, I've become that crazy aunt that like forces pictures on people, and I think everything he does is amazing. So as his aunt, aunts and uncle and mom, we kind of watch in amazement as Sammy builds these things, and we're like, wow, what is he going to make out of the blocks this time? Look at what he made. Like, surely this shows he's going to be a genius. And all of these things. What if God was hovering in all these different spheres of our lives more like that? More like a God who has said, hey, I created you to be a co-creator with me. Look, I've given you all these raw materials. They're all over the place in every single room somehow. What are you going to make? What are you going to do as you're walking through the grocery store? There's these cool-looking fruits from a different part of the world. I see they're in your grocery cart. What are you going to make out of those? What if God was hovering as this creative, excited parent or aunt, wondering, what are we going to make? What are we going to do? How are we going to create with him in all of these different rooms that are part of his house? God is everywhere, and that brings a unity into our lives that feel often quite fractured. He begins to show us how actually it all does fit together, and he brings things into alignment. One of the things the Board of Stewards is doing is trying to put this whole idea of a rule of life into practice, and so we've spoken dangerously out how we are going to do this, and now we're going to try and hold each other accountable to it. But it was really cool to hear them share yesterday morning in the living room. We all kind of went around and shared, not like, here are six things I'm going to now do in my life, but here is one thing I'm trying to work on, one practice that I want to put in my life so that I recognize that all of this is God's house, that he's in every room with me. And so some of the things that were mentioned was, one was just in the busyness of life, sometimes finding it hard to still our minds. And so seeking out space that is quiet, which might be a church, a more traditional church that's open all the time. And, you know, it may be on lunch hour, being able to go into that space to find quiet and remember that in the middle of my workday, God is present. In the middle of this city, there is quiet, there is space, there is a sense of his holiness. Another was setting a timer on your phone to help remember to pray. We want to pray. Sometimes it's hard to just remember in the middle of trying to hold all the things in our lives together. Setting a timer on the phone to go off just at different segments in the day. And when that goes off, to remember, yes, God is here. He is in the middle of my email inbox. I'm just going to take a moment, and I'm going to invite him in to open my eyes and show him me where he is at work in my inbox that is overflowing, or whatever it is. As we begin to recognize all the spheres, all the areas of our lives as rooms in God's house, in his temple, it begins to draw our lives together. The other implication that I want to draw out is, especially for those of you who have worked at camps, who have ever been counselors at camps, so I'm looking at you teenagers trying to make eye contact. You know that feeling when you have been a camper and then you suddenly go in, and then you become, that summer you become a counselor, and the shift, the way that things change, the way you look at your camp slightly differently. I remember as a camper, you go in and it's like this glorious world of fun that's set up for you. And you go and you kind of almost have like servants who are making fun things happen for you all the time. It's the best. And you go in and there's all these glorious things that aren't part of your everyday life. And you go and you experience and you absorb and it's wonderful. Well, being in creation is kind of like that. God has created a world for us with many wonderful things that we get to enjoy. But he has also made us his image bearers, which means there is responsibility that goes along with our role in his world. The summer that I shifted from camper to counselor was the summer that I did LIT at Ontario Pioneer Camp, and they set it up so that the first part, you're a camper, and the second part, you are a counselor, and they send you out, and you're paired with another counselor. So the first part, there's lots of crazy fun, and you're like, I get this, I've been here before. And then the second part feels weird, and suddenly you're in the dining hall, and you are the one serving, and you are the one hosting these little campers. And what I discovered was that I actually liked being a counselor better than I liked being a camper. Because I began to see the camp in a new way. It was still this glorious, amazing, fun place. But I had a certain role. There was a certain responsibility, a certain power that I now had in this. And my role was to be a gracious host and to make sure these kids had the most fun when they arrived. I got to create things, invent new ways of having fun in this space. As an adult, perhaps another analogy is to think of the difference between being a guest and being a host. We are royal representatives of God in this world. We are no longer campers. We are counselors. We are hosts. And we walk around in this world as visual representations of who God is and as representations of who he is. God is at work in this world healing and he is at work in this world making things new. And so no matter what he has called you to do in terms of our vocation and jobs, this is our first calling, is to be part of healing and making things new, being gracious hosts. So what would that look like if we were to take on this attitude shift from camper to counselor in our world? That as we walk through our neighborhoods, we are not there just as anyone walking through a neighborhood. We are there with a specific role, with a responsibility. That's wonderful. We are there as gracious hosts to our neighbors in this space, making sure that life is flourishing in all the places we are, in our workplace. We're not just there as any old other worker. We are there with a royal mandate, which is hard to wrap our heads around. But we are there to care for others, to help cultivate life in that place. Now, there's a lot more that we could talk about in terms of what this actually looks like, and it leads us right into Genesis chapter 2. It anticipates that by the end of Genesis chapter 1, we're going to be going, wait, what does this actually look like then? Well, next week we're going to go into Genesis chapter 2, so I'm leaving us on a bit of a cliffhanger, but that begins to work out what our role looks like in this world. But it begins with an attitude shift. It begins with looking at this place and seeing ourselves in God's home. Begins with valuing creation as a place that God loves and has called good, and seeing ourselves in it as representation of God, as having responsibility as hosts in this world.